From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, New York Times columnist Jim Rutenberg unpacks the complicated relationship between Saudi Arabia and U.S. media companies. Then comedian Mo Ahmer's stand-up special draws from his experiences touring the world as a Muslim American.
I find myself after shows, people from all different backgrounds yelling, "Muhammad! Yeah, Muhammad!" Like they're celebrating it. They're almost really excited to be a part of something new and fresh.
And some kids dream of playing music in a band. Dieter Ruhl dreamed of playing in Dodger Stadium. All that coming up on The Frame.
Podcasting supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures. Based on a true story, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Stars Melissa McCarthy as Lee Israel, an author who turns her art into deception when she can't make ends meet. In select theaters Friday.
2 weeks ago, Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, and he hasn't been seen since. He's presumed to have been murdered, and Turkish officials said his body was dismembered. The Saudi government initially said it didn't know anything about his disappearance, but today it reportedly will admit that he died in an interrogation. The Khashoggi story has sparked outrage around the world, and some of that anger is echoing around Hollywood and Silicon Valley, where Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been wooing media and tech moguls. Those CEOs were happy to meet with him, even though the country has a terrible record when it comes to human rights and free speech. I Skyped today with Jim Rutenberg, the media columnist for The New York Times. He's written about the problematic relationship American tech and media companies have with Saudi Arabia.
I'll take you back to the spring of this year when the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, blew through New York and Hollywood on what was effectively a charm offensive, seeking both investment in Saudi Arabia and to make investments in businesses here.
And it seems like there are two parts to that. One is the actual money, and then there's the kind of personal contact relationship part of it. So let's talk about the money first. The WME Talent Agency has a $400 million deal from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is controlled by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And then several theater chains that have ties to the United States have been working to build theaters in Saudi Arabia. So there's a financial benefit to Hollywood in all of this, right?
Yeah, because the Crown Prince, what you can't take away from him and what he did do was he's liberalized his country's form of Islam. And that has sort of most obviously resulted in the opening of movie theaters for the first time in 35 years, which would make Saudi Arabia, I think, for United States filmmakers, like the number 10 market in the world. And he allowed women to drive and attend more sort of public events more freely. So for the American studios, this is a big deal.
And then there's the kind of personal PR campaign. You call it a charm offensive. And Mohammed bin Salman was meeting with people like producer Brian Grazer, Disney head Bob Iger, Fox's Rupert Murdoch, Google's Sergey Brin, and maybe potentially worst of all, Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos, because Khashoggi was a columnist at the paper. What was Saudi Arabia trying to do and say about itself in those personal meetings?
The story he was telling, that here is the new face of Saudi Arabia, the young, technocratic, modern leader. I can give you a Saudi Arabia that is safe to associate with, that is safe to come bring your movies to and build theaters in. And also our money is safe for you to have as an investment, which is very welcome for all of these players for various reasons. So the story helps sort of make the money much cleaner.
And you say that while Saudi Arabia represses free speech and has been hostile to some journalists, it also embraces some forms of propaganda. Can you tell us about the magazine The New Kingdom and its publisher, American Media, Inc.?
For the last 10 months, I've been covering the American Media, Inc., which owns The Inquirer, and its work in helping to cover up at least two affairs, alleged affairs involving then-candidate Trump in 2016. And shortly before the Crown Prince came to the States, a glossy magazine landed on newsstands all over the country. It was called The New Kingdom, and it was just glossy in every sense of the word, just a very positive, glowing view of the new prince, the new kingdom, as it called it. And it was confusing. Why did AMI print this? And what we quickly found out was because David Pecker, the chairman, and AMI in general, was seeking business in and with Saudi Arabia.
You write in your column, I'm quoting it now, there's a streak in American journalism to allow glittering narratives about budding authoritarians to obscure less appealing facts. Is there a teachable moment in all of this, even though, as you know, it's not the first time that something like this has happened?
To me, it always goes back to the basics. And it's not trust but verify. It's verify before you trust. You know, so basically, for all the positive things we've seen of early, young, what I call later budding authoritarians, next generation leaders in the Middle East who promise they're going to make change, you just have to make sure the proof ends up being in the pudding. You can't get ahead of the rhetoric and in some cases some real action. Again, you know, the Crown Prince did indeed institute some change, but what's beneath the surface? What else is going on? You know, for instance, he allowed women to drive. That's a big deal. Yet feminist activists, including some who were fighting for the right to drive, were jailed at the same time because they kind of got out of the, they went a little too far for the regime's comfort. So I think we all just have to watch it. You can't blame people for wanting to have hope. But journalistically, I think you just have to always stay grounded in what are the facts and just look at the whole picture.
I think it's fair to say that the moral compass of Hollywood and media companies tends to swing away from morality and back toward money pretty quickly. And even if a lot of companies, not just media companies, are pulling out of Davos in the Desert, the big event in Riyadh coming up, do you think this is going to last? Or is what's going to happen what's happened in the past, that everybody stops, you know, pauses, and then ends up going back to be in business with people in countries like this?
I mean, call me a cynic, but I think if there's any fig leaf of a reason to get back involved in, again, what could become for Hollywood a top 10 global entertainment market, I think they will find a way back in. And the point of my column was that you didn't need Khashoggi to disappear to have plenty of reasons to be very wary. There are other things going on, but would that be enough for everyone to rush back in?
Jim Rutenberg is the media columnist for the New York Times, and this story keeps evolving. Since taping that conversation, William Morris Endeavor announced that it's canceling its planned $400 million deal with the Saudi government. Comedian Mo Ammer didn't have what you would call a typical American childhood. His family fled Kuwait during the first Gulf War and settled in Houston. As a refugee kid growing up in Texas and with the name Mohammed, he learned early on that being funny could be a useful skill. In 2005, Ammer joined the Muslim American comedy group Allah Made Me Funny, founded by Bryant Preacher Moss and Azar Usman. Ammer later toured with Dave Chappelle, who we should say converted to Islam in 1998. And since Ammer didn't get U.S. citizenship until 2009, much of his globetrotting was done with just a refugee travel document. Coincidentally, in 2016, right after Donald Trump was elected, Ammer had a chance encounter with Eric Trump that went viral. All of these experiences show up in Ammer's new Netflix special, The Vagabond. When we talked about the special, I asked Ammer how he transforms difficult moments from his life into comedy.
The best stand-up to me always comes from those types of situations. So, you know, I started stand-up when I was 14 years old. So for me, it was always finding a way to you know, take something that's very sad and that has some very upsetting realities to it and make it funny. And also that humanizes the situation as I do so. So I wasn't like necessarily intentional. I mean, it is, but it wasn't. You know, my intention is obviously to make people laugh, but it's also a form of therapy for myself. You know, it's not easy to endure such hurdles in life and flee war and end up in Houston and then tour stand-up in the South. Though obviously 9/11 happened 2 years into me doing professional stand-up, and next thing you know, I'm still touring the South. And it's very, very difficult, but people are very, very receptive to it. They love it, actually. And although that I go by Mo, I find myself after shows, people from all different backgrounds yelling Muhammad from across the street, like on a regular regular basis, like, Muhammad, yeah, Muhammad. Like, they're celebrating it. They're almost really excited to be a part of something new and fresh.
In the Netflix special, The Vagabond, you imitate a lot of regional and foreign accents. I want to play one from the special.
He was like, say, Vato, you walk by here every day. You don't say nothing, don't do nothing. What? You ashamed of your own peoples, bro? Andale, bro, you're gonna get broke today, bro. What's your name, bro? Andale, what's your name? I was like, oh man, my name is Muhammad. He's like, what? For real, bro? You look exactly like Hector, I swear to God, bro.
It's very funny, but I have to ask you a question. If like a white person did like accents like that, I think we'd be in a lot of trouble. So how do you get away with that? How are you able to pull that off?
Well, first of all, it's extremely accurate. If I was doing like a horrific impersonation of any accent, I don't do an Australian accent because I'm terrible at it, you know? So I just don't do it. Or I don't do any other, you know, Indian accent because I don't do it well. But if I did, I would definitely do it. I think that's the thing. And also I speak Spanish, you know, for some, I don't know. I that's the only thing I could say to it. But I've never had one problem, not a single person ever taken offense to any of it. And if they did, I don't know what to tell you. You know, like my heart and my intention is the right place. All I'm doing is just trying to paint a particular picture of my real life experiences. And the fact that I have the ability to emulate and do different accents is just helps paint that picture.
I want to ask you about something that was really important in breaking your career, and that is the comedy troupe Allah Made Me Funny. What was the political climate like when you joined, and how have you seen your tour and tours like it change and become more relevant, especially after the Muslim travel ban?
I mean, it's pretty amazing that Allah Made Me Funny started as a comedy tour in 2004. Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. Only 3 years removed from LA. How ahead of the curve was this situation? I mean, it's amazing. So I joined like late, actually, 2005 when we started doing shows together. And I saw how relevant it is. It was like basically getting a master's degree or a PhD in stand-up and touring, because we ended up making that into a documentary stand-up film. And then we ended up touring the world together. I mean, we went to 20-plus countries together doing theaters abroad, where that was pre-Netflix or any global platform that can help you do that, aside from, like, YouTube. From South Africa, Nelson Mandela Theater, 4,000 in Durban, South Africa. I mean, it's incredible what we were able to pull off. It influenced a lot of comedians. The climate itself was obviously very thick. However, people, or especially our communities, definitely needed an outlet or a voice. And Preacher Moss had that in mind when he started it and co-founded it with Azhar. And when they asked me to join a year later, I was really hesitant because it was a lot of pressure, you know, to tour under that kind of name. And also, you know, my ambitions and what I wanted from stand-up and what it could potentially do. And I'm so glad I did it, because I feel like I came up to the plate swinging three bats, you know.
We're talking with Mo Ammer. His new Netflix special is called The Vagabond. A couple of years ago, you got to sit next to somebody named Eric Trump. Let's listen how you set this story up in your special.
I didn't know I was going to get upgraded into first class, much less sit next to Eric Trump. But I do know one thing. The lady that upgraded me is probably a Clinton supporter. Let's be real. I'm just saying, she was probably sitting there like, oh, Eric Trump is on my flight. Okay, I don't know why she has a mustache. Okay. Oh, there's an empty seat next to Eric. Okay. Let me take a look at this upgrade list. See who's standing by patiently here. Oh, Muhammad Mustafa Ammer. Upgrade this motherfucker immediately. You know, that's probably what happened.
There's also a great photo of you next to Eric Trump. Eric Trump is wearing a sweater with the Trump, I guess, family crest on it. Obviously, like, a totally unexpected development, but you used it, and not just for material. I think you had a conversation with Eric Trump about what it was like to be a Muslim.
I did. Yes, I did. I just sat down next to him and told him immediately how I felt. It was like 3 weeks after his, about 3 weeks after his father was elected, and sat down next to him, and I was like, "Salam alaikum, Eric. How's it going, man?" And he started laughing, and I said, "Oh, man, I had to mess with you a little bit. I'm a comedian, I'm Muslim, and I just want to let you know that I came here as a refugee. Surprise, too late." And then I told him, I said, "Hey, man, Muslims are not going to do this Muslim identification bull that you have in mind. We're just not going to do it." I was busting his balls a little bit. Then I realized really quickly that Eric is just part of that system. You know, he's part of his father's system. And I felt like he was just raised a particular way to execute and do a particular thing. And I don't, you know, he was just going to check in on a golf course for 24 hours. That's what he's doing. He's his dad's errand boy.
Right.
That's how it felt to me. And I was just like, hey, let's just have a conversation with this guy, see who he is. And I was trying to see if he would get drunk and maybe leak some stuff, but he didn't do it. He didn't do it. He passed out pretty quickly, and so did I. I was exhausted. I came from a flight from Australia. So I had a 24-hour layover from Australia heading to Scotland to start a 25-city tour. I really didn't care that much. But I took a picture, and then I posted it, and I basically passed out after, thinking, haha, my fans and stuff will find it funny, and my friends, kind of thing. Had no clue I was going to wake up like in a movie when I turn on my phone, we land in Scotland, and my phone just starts, it just looks like what they do in the movies. Like, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. The numbers kept getting higher and higher. And from that, I'm checking my emails. There's like every publication and outlet that I've ever admired and wanted to do an interview with, including also was like every other publication that I can't stand. It was just like everyone was coming at me. I couldn't believe it. I really, really couldn't. I was stunned by it. And he turned on his phone. Eric turned on his phone, and he looked at me, and I looked at him. It was almost like we had like a bad one night stand. Like, maybe we immediately regretted it. We're like, hey, man, maybe we shouldn't have done this kind of thing. And it was just too late. We didn't say a word to each other afterward.
You have a broad reach in your comedy. You're going to places like Kuwait and Iraq. You are playing all over the world. And I'm wondering if you notice how your comedy translates to different audiences, considering where they're based. And also, if you see your role in that equationist kind of comedian slash diplomat, that you are telling stories to people who may not understand or know those stories. Those people could be in the United States as well. They could be our neighbors who don't really understand the perspective that you're trying to share.
Man, it's interesting you say diplomat, because a lot of people are like, oh, you're out there bringing us together. I'm doing this. I'm like, yeah, I'm just trying to be funny and share my experiences. Don't put this pressure on me, guys. Easy. You see how politicians get treated to me? I want nothing to do with that. Knock, knock. Who's there? That's me. Okay? That's who I am. Please don't put me in that bucket. But if it ends up making a difference and impacting people like that and creating some dialogue, then of course I'm all for that. There's a reason why I'm telling those stories. But I'm a comedian. Please keep calling me that.
Mo Amer is a comedian, and he has a new Netflix special. It's called The Vagabond. Mo, thanks so much for coming on The Frame.
Oh, man, thank you for having me.
The Vagabond is on Netflix right now. Coming up, when you go to Dodger Stadium, close your eyes and listen for the music of Dieter Ruhl.
Podcasting supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Can You Ever Forgive Me? Melissa McCarthy stars as real-life celebrity biographer turned literary forger Lee Israel. Richard E. Grant co-stars as her accomplice, Jack, in select theaters Friday.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Josh Fox with his new work, The Truth Has Changed. From the director of Gasland comes a live performance tracing the arc of American politics from 9/11 to Trump. From his experiences as an eyewitness to 9/11, the BP oil spill, Bernie Sanders campaign, and Standing Rock, Fox delivers an insightful account of how we got to where we are today. October 27th at Brood Playhouse. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Later this week on the show, we head to the Universal lot to meet Asim Batra. She's the creator of the new NBC comedy, I Feel Bad. It features a working mom at the center of the comedy, and its producers include Amy Poehler. Batra talks about how her own experiences as a mom writing on different TV series shaped the story and how she surprised herself by casting an Indian-American actress in the lead role. I also talk with actor Peter Dinklage and filmmaker Sasha Gervaisi. Their movie, My Dinner with Hervé, tells the story of the troubled life of Hervé Villechaize, the famed French actor who played Tatou on Fantasy Island. It took more than a decade to get the film made, but once Dinklage became a star on Game of Thrones, the movie eventually was able to attract some backing. But now, with the Dodgers returning to L.A. tonight for the third game of the NLCS, we're going to revisit an interview with an unseen, but definitely not unheard, member of the team's organization. And that's Dieter Ruhle. He's the organist who's perched high in Dodger Stadium. He provides the soundtrack to the team's home games. Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited with Ruhle over the summer.
Hi, my name is Dieter Ruhle, the organist for the Dodgers. I've heard that people think I'm just up here pushing buttons, you know, that even the organ stuff's pre-recorded. But then again, on the other side of it, I've heard some people say that they've noticed, oh yeah, there's no way that can be recorded, which makes me happy to know that they've noticed like these little subtle things I'll do to make things not always exactly the same, to give it a live feel. I'm originally from L.A., born in Van Nuys, grew up in North Hollywood and Burbank. My father, his parents emigrated from Germany, and my mother is Mexican, and I look nothing like her. But she liked the name, so my Mexican mother chose the German first name. I studied classical piano starting when I was about 9 or 10. I studied music composition and theory in junior college at LAVC. My musical aspirations, I guess, were always in sports. Like, I was never in a band or anything like that. I got involved doing sports when I was a teenager, doing indoor soccer at the Forum. And that led to doing hockey, which led to doing basketball, which led to DJing, which led to me doing events like all around the world, like different Olympics and events for the NBA and All-Star Games. Usually for a 7:10 start, I arrive at Dodger Stadium around between 3 and 3:30. I'll put together a playlist on my iPad here, and then I'll get the rundown from our producer, and I'll mark up my cues, like when to play and what to play. And like, I'll know, for example, okay, mid-second we have Military Hero, so I'll see which branch of the military they're from. Okay, today it's, I think they're from the Navy, so I'll play Anchors Away. Usually I accompany the national anthem singer.
Please welcome Trisha Makiko Lopez.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
And then throughout the game, usually while the Dodgers are batting, play little snippets of songs here and there along with the charges and Let's Go Dodgers. Middle of the seventh, it's time for the seventh inning stretch, so I play Take Me Out to the Ball Game, which I love. It's pretty awesome. And then after the games are over, I'll play for a few minutes post-game, too. Last night we lost, and I played The Way It Is by Bruce Hornsby. And sometimes I'll play Under the Milky Way Tonight by The Church. And I always end it with Closing Time, Semisonic. It's definitely a show. There's pre-planned elements, like we'll know we're doing a Kiss Cam at this inning break. But that being said, it is a live sporting event. So there are things that you don't expect, you have to be ready for, you know, pitching changes or delays or, you know, video reviews or just the game itself, you know. The previous organist here, Nancy B. Heffley, she told me that once as a bit of advice. She goes, just whatever you do, don't think. And that's so true, because I'll catch myself, and if I've goofed, if I've hit a wrong key here or there, it's like, it's because I'm thinking. But if I just let it go, if I just go with what I feel, then it just comes out the way it should, I think. I'm kind of a Star Wars nerd, and you know, there's the whole Obi-Wan Kenobi to Luke, you know, trust your feelings, Luke. It's so true, I think. Yeah, yeah.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Greeting.
And that is The Frame on a Monday. You can always get this show as a podcast. It's available wherever you like to listen, including Spotify, iTunes, and the NPR One app. We'll be back here on KPCC tomorrow. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.